This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Madeline Brand in California.
And I'm Robert Siegel in Washington, where tomorrow President Obama delivers his State of the Union message. One big question is what he will say and then do about health care. We asked two healthcare economists with different political backgrounds what they think is feasible in the way of healthcare legislation now that there are 41 Republican votes against the Senate Democrats' bill. In a moment, we'll hear from Gail Walensky, who has served Republicans on health policy. First, Professor Uwe Reinhardt of Princeton, who says the Senate bill is still worth passing.
The idea of taking the Senate bill, have the House endorse it, and then pass it into law is not as far-fetched as even the president seemed to have make it appear. Because the Senate bill does many of the things Americans want. Americans need help buying health insurance. Well, it does that. Americans don't want the premiums based on their own health status. The bill outlaws that. Americans don't want rescission, that is, having their insurance canceled after an illness strikes. This bill outlaws that.
But it's not as though the administration or Democrats in the House or the Senate have not been describing these bills for the past year. We've heard a tremendous amount. The president talks about them every week, it seems.
Well, there's a difference between oratory and pedagogy. Oratory means you string the emotions of people. Pedagogy means you actually teach people carefully. I haven't seen either from the Senate, which is, of course, not even their job, or from this president an attempt to really explain to the people what's in the bill. I give speeches, and I have that in two slides. I can explain it really quite simply. And I'm stunned that the president has not either thought about it or taken the time to do it, to tell people these are the things that bug you, and here is precisely what this bill does about it. Everything that was communicated seemed that there was chaos, that there were sleazy deals. Of course there is log rolling. Log rolling in the Congress is an old American tradition. It wasn't invented by the Senate bill. I don't know why the president never became the teacher of the people and always resorts either to two modes. One is oratory, and the other one is sort of graduate school seminars, which are fine for eggheads like me, but they're not good for people who drive in a car and need different pedagogic devices. They need anecdotes. They need metaphors. None of that the president uses.
Let's say the Republicans say, you know what's always near the top of our list when it comes to health care. It's tort reform. It's reforming the system of malpractice insurance in the country, which President Obama only went so far as to say, okay, maybe some pilot projects to look at alternative ways of dispute resolution. Are the Democrats capable, or would it be worth it, even if it's for a small share of the health care dollars, to meet the Republicans halfway on that question?
I think they should have. I think at the very least it was discourteous not to have done it. But I believe the recent CBO report on malpractice shows it would actually yield savings if we had major reform. There are some great ideas out on this. They've been out, for 20 or more years. It's called alternative dispute resolution that takes this roulette wheel of jury rooms out of the proceedings and separates whether a patient got hurt and needs help from whether a physician was negligent. All of these ideas are out there, and for a comprehensive health insurance bill, not to have embraced that facet of it is actually rather inexcusable.
Uwe Reinhardt of Princeton, thank you very much for talking with us today.
It's been my pleasure, Bob.
And now Gail Walensky, who is a healthcare economist who served as White House health policy advisor to President George H.W. Bush, ran Medicare and Medicaid, and later served as an advisor on health policy to Senator John McCain during his run for the White House. Thanks a lot for joining us. Welcome.
My pleasure to be with you.
Uwe Reinhardt's reading of where we stand now is the Senate health care bill is a good bill. It's been very badly sold by President Obama. But if he could get the message down, Pat, it would still be a good solution to our problems. What do you say?
There are three significant problems in healthcare. The Senate bill primarily focused on one and did it reasonably well. That is, expanding coverage to a substantial number of the uninsured. Did very little for the other two, which is slowing healthcare spending and improving the value and the quality for what we spend. Those are extremely important, much harder problems. Disappointing that we were making so little progress even when healthcare reform was looking more promising.
What right now do you think, speaking of promising, what do you think the prospects are? Is it simply finished and in another year perhaps Washington will take another swing at it, or is there something that can be revived from what now is on Capitol Hill?
I believe there are three options and none of them are terribly appealing. Nothing is done. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, the problems remain and the challenges are there, so that's a problem. There is a bill that is pushed through reconciliation, the budget process.
You mean without needing 60 votes?
Without needing 60 votes. That would be a very big mistake. The public is already feeling that they're not getting the kind of change they were promised in terms of how Washington does its business. This would only reinforce that. A third is to have an incremental bill. That won't be so easy to do. Medicaid expansion for some of the uninsured, insurance reforms, maybe a few other changes. Won't satisfy the Democratic base. It won't be easy to get, but it's probably the most possible of those three. I hope there'll be an attempt.
Do you think there are Republican votes for such bills?
It will be hard. It will be harder now than it would have been a year ago. There's a lot of jaundiced views. People like Orrin Hatch, who have had a history of being a part of bipartisan bills, walked away very angrily from what was going on in the Senate. One of the great losses that Senator Kennedy was not actively involved in the health care reform debate. It's possible. It will be hard. It's worth the effort.
Professor Reinhardt agreed that it was a great mistake on the part of the Democrats not to have some nod toward malpractice reform in their approach to health care. Do you agree?
I do agree. I think if you want to have physicians practice in a more conservative way, if you want to have hospitals be a little less aggressive, you've got to provide them with some assurance that they won't be sued if there's a bad outcome. Can use the interest in evidence-based medicine so that if physicians and hospitals introduce some patient safety measures approved by the Institute of Medicine and follow the guidelines of the various specialty societies, they should be protected unless there's some kind of criminal negligence.
If the alternative to all of this, if one possible alternative is status quo, how bad is that?
Very bad. We have challenges we must take on. 15% of the population, almost 50 million, about 45 million right now without health insurance coverage, is a serious problem to the individuals and the communities where they live, and it's wrong. But we also have, for all of us that have coverage, unsustainable growth in healthcare spending, already at 17% of our GDP and growing. And we have a lot of quality problems. We don't get what we need at the right time. We have patient safety measures. We really have to take these issues on, and they're hard. They won't be easy to fix.
Gail Wilensky, thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
That's healthcare economist Gail Wilensky. We also heard from Professor Uwe Reinhardt of Princeton University.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel in Washington.
And I'm Madeline Brand in California. Some good news and some bad news today out of the Congressional Budget Office. The good news, this year's deficit is a bit lower than last year's. The bad news, it's still more than $1.3 trillion. President Obama and Congress agree that something should be done, but a bipartisan commission that would have presumably done something got shot down in the Senate today, and President Obama's proposal to freeze discretionary spending for 3 years is receiving a lukewarm response. NPR's David Wellner reports.
Like a prophet crying out in the wilderness, Senate Budget Committee Chairman Ken Conrad has been admonishing his colleagues for months to empower a commission to make the difficult choices Congress can't seem to make. Conrad's aim is to bring greater balance to the budget, both by cutting spending and by raising taxes.
Anybody who says we don't have to do anything, we can just keep on doing what we're doing, has got their head in the sand. Social Security and Medicare are both cash negative today. They are both headed for insolvency. Those who say we don't have to do anything, they are guaranteeing a disaster.
The 18-member commission Conrad has proposed would be made up almost entirely of sitting lawmakers, whose members would be appointed by congressional leaders of both parties and the president. Their recommendations would be voted on by Congress without any amendments and would only pass with 60% of the votes in each chamber. Judd Gregg, who's the top Republican on the budget panel, joined Conrad in proposing the commission.
Regular order doesn't work around here. So unless you have fast-track approval, unless you have an up or down vote, unless you have no amendments, and unless you have a balanced commission with a supermajority to report, you don't get bipartisanship, you don't get fairness, and you don't get action.
But Max Baucus, who chairs the Tax Writing Finance Committee, vehemently opposed the deficit commission. He said lawmakers were elected to make precisely the kind of hard choices needed to cut deficits.
The regular order does work here. 1990, 1993, 1997, Congress passed through reconciliation budget resolutions that worked. And I believe, frankly, that we have it within ourselves as senators can do the same again.
53 senators, including 13 Republicans, voted for the commission, but that was short the 60 votes needed. As a fallback, President Obama is expected to name such a commission, but Congress would not be bound to vote on its recommendations. In another move to cut deficits, President Obama is expected to announce in his State of the Union address tomorrow a three-year freeze in spending that would exclude defense and entitlement expenditures. The president's proposal got a cool reception today from Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid.
We'll have to look and see what the president's talking about cutting. We have to make sure that we have money for education. We have to make sure we have money to take care of our civil society.
Republicans generally hailed the proposed spending freeze as a step in the right direction. Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell did so with a caveat.
I think any indication the administration is trying to reduce the spending is a good thing, but we've been on quite a binge over the last 12 months, and it's going to take a lot more than just this kind of modest freeze to get us back on the right track.
McConnell and other Republicans say one way to rein in spending is not to raise the ceiling on the national debt by $1.9 trillion, as the White House has requested. They'd rather do it in small increments, forcing Democrats to take a series of tough votes this election year. David Wellner, NPR News, The Capitol.
Today, Toyota told its dealers to stop selling 8 models of cars and trucks. Last week, the automaker announced a recall of 2.3 million of the vehicles because of problems with the accelerator pedal sticking. The vehicles involved include the 2010 Highlander, the 2009 and 10 RAV4, Corolla and Matrix, as well as wider model year recalls on the Avalon, Camry, Tundra, and Sequoia. For more on what this means for Toyota, I'm joined now by Paul Eisenstein. He's editor of the auto industry website, thedetroitbureau.com. Hi, Paul.
Hi, Madeline. Good to be with you.
So this is not the first time we are hearing about a Toyota vehicle recall. Tell us what's been happening.
Well, Toyota has been slammed with recalls this last year. In fact, in 2009, they recalled something like 4 times more vehicles than they ever have in a single year here in the United States, more than 4 million in total.
So this involves a sticking accelerator and also a floor mat problem?
Well, yeah, we want to separate the two. The recall that they announced last October after the fiery death of a California state trooper and his family involved floor mats that can stick. The technical term is entrap the accelerator pedal and leading vehicles to go out of control. This new problem involves the accelerator pedals themselves. They can apparently stick wide open and make it very difficult to stop as well. Some of the vehicles involved in the current recall, the new one, are also involved in the previous recall.
So total, how many vehicles are we talking about?
Well, if you added up the numbers, it's somewhere north of 6.5 million vehicles. But again, some of them are involved. The same vehicle may be recalled for two different repairs. So if you take out the overlap, you're still talking about somewhere in the neighborhood of 5 million.
And what about today's announcement? What does that mean, that dealers should stop selling these eight models?
Well, we're all trying to figure out exactly what this means. It certainly is going to be a problem. You've got a company that sells an awful lot of cars. It actually sold more cars in retail in December than General Motors did. And now it's telling its dealers to stop selling some of the most important products in its lineup. Plus, it's shutting down a number of factories, including five factories here in North America, at least the lines that produce these models. So it's really going to throw that company and its dealers into chaos.
There have been complaints for a number of years now, I understand, from consumers about this accelerator problem. Has Toyota been slow to acknowledge it?
They've clearly been slow to acknowledge it. And it took that fiery death of a California trooper last year to push them into making the recall, the first recall of 3.8 million vehicles because of the floor mat problem. This newer recall, they appear to be much more sensitive to problems with accelerator sticking. So they move pretty quickly. But it appears that they've got some other problems, and now they're trying to decide just how fast they're going to have to respond to yet another series of complaints about quality and reliability.
With the Prius, too.
Yeah, we broke a story just before the new year about a problem that's apparently involving the third generation Prius, which is the face of Toyota. It now appears that, at least under some conditions, people are reporting that when they're braking, if they hit a pothole or a bump, the brakes can essentially release. And this is a real problem. If you're in a tight traffic situation and your brakes suddenly let go, you may not have enough time to reapply them.
Paul Eisenstein is editor of the auto industry website, thedetroitbureau.com. Thanks, Paul.
Good to be with you.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
The tale of Alice's Adventures in Wonderland has fascinated readers ever since its publication in 1865. But a new novel explores the possibility that the charms of Lewis Carroll's classic may have eventually faded for the real-life Alice. Book critic Maureen Corrigan has a review of Melanie Benjamin's new novel based on the life of a young muse called Alice I Have Been.
Like most preteen heroines of classic children's literature, Alice, of Alice in Wonderland, of course, is a mistress of misrule, bossy, resourceful, and a bit of a tomboy. Despite that perfectly starched getup of pinafore and pantalettes capped off by blonde curls, Alice chafes against convention. That's why she fits in just fine in the psychedelic netherworld of Wonderland, and also why she's been beloved ever after by restless girl readers and feminist scholars. No wonder that the first words that Alice utters in the opening lines of Melanie Benjamin's haunting new novel about the real Alice, Alice Liddell, are words of soft rebellion. But, oh, my dear, I am tired of being Alice in Wonderland. Does it sound ungrateful? It is. Only I do get tired. The year is 1932, and Alice Liddell is 80 years old. She's writing those words in a letter to her son, who implores her to leave her home in England and sail to New York, where Columbia University is eager to bestow upon her an honorary doctorate and a tea party. The occasion is the celebration of the centenary of the birth of Arthur Dodgson, a.k.a. Lewis Carroll, and it really did happen. One certainly can imagine that Alice Liddell felt both tickled by that ongoing attention and trapped, because the tale that gave her and so many generations of readers such anarchic pleasure also paradoxically fixed the real Alice to a fictional identity, one that she could never quite outrun. Melanie Benjamin's novel is called Alice I Have Been, and though it occasionally stumbles into melodrama, most of the time it's a nuanced, moody envisioning of the life of Alice Liddell. Alice, as any Wonderland fan knows, was a daughter of the Dean of Christ Church College at Oxford, where Arthur Dodgson was a stuttering mathematics don. As the origin myth goes, one golden summer afternoon, Dodgson and 10-year-old Alice, along with some companions, went for a boat ride, and he spun out the tale of Alice in Wonderland, which she begged him to write down. There's certainly enough suggestively weird imagery lurking in Alice in Wonderland to give any post-Freudian reader pause. But coupled with the fact that Dodgson, an early photography enthusiast, took pictures of young girls, including a famous one of the 7-year-old Alice scantily clad as a gypsy waif, Benjamin's rendering of Dodgson as a gentle ancestor of Humbert Humbert seems warranted. In this finely detailed snippet, Alice recalls undressing for that gypsy girl outdoor photo shoot and her dawning awareness of the more mundane dimensions of her own upper-class female helplessness. I took the gypsy dress, held it up to me, then dropped it to the ground. Clutching my own skirt, I fingered the stiff, familiar lace like a good luck charm. Then I realized something very important. I realized I had never before undressed myself. All my buttons were in the back. Every night I obediently turned around and waited for someone to unbutton all of them, help me step out of the billowing fabric, unfasten all my petticoats, again, all of which fastened at my back. Every night, someone did. Unexpectedly, Benjamin's novel becomes even more interesting in its second half, as Alice grows into a young woman struggling to shrug off her Alice mantle, as well as the whispers in Oxford of something untoward in her past relationship with Dodgson, who was indeed banned by Alice's family from seeing her and her sisters a year after that immortal boat ride. Alice I Have Been graces and imagined Alice Liddell with her own voice and story. But what really sets this latest Victorian fictional resurrection apart is its awareness of the demonic dimension of great literature. Powerful stories captivate their readers and sometimes also their muses. As Benjamin vividly depicts here, the young girl who became the muse for one of the most rollicking children's tales of all time may have also become, to some extent, its prisoner, pressed into the looking glass of its fictions.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Alice I Have Been by Melanie Benjamin.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Madeline Brand. The Olympics are a mammoth industry. Next month's Winter Games in Vancouver will cost more than $1.5 billion. 5,500 athletes from more than 80 countries will compete. We're going to hear now about a time when the Olympics were much simpler and much smaller. Our co-host, Melissa Block, is visiting an earlier Olympic host city.
Well, a small town, really. Lake Placid, New York, nestled in the Adirondack Mountains. Just a few thousand people live here, and it cherishes its bragging rights. Tiny Lake Placid considers itself the winter sports capital of the world, home to not one, but two Olympics.
I welcome you, the representatives of many of our sister nations, to this, the opening of the third Winter Olympic Games.
In 1932, then-New York Governor Franklin D. Roosevelt opened the Lake Placid Games. Lake Placid hosted the Games again in 1980, the year the U.S. Olympic hockey team beat the Soviet Union in the Miracle on Ice.
They said it was impossible. The United States has upset the Soviet Union. I can't believe it. This is a miracle. I can't believe it.
That's longtime Lake Placidian Sandy Caligiuri calling the 1980 game for the local radio station WNBZ. I meet up with him in the shadow of that hockey arena. We lace up some skates and glide onto the 400-meter Olympic speed skating oval. It's outdoors, uncovered, where more history was made in 1980.
We are right here, literally, in the footsteps of where Eric Heiden won his 5 gold medals in 1980. You know?
It feels very small town America. We're right on Main Street.
Yeah, this is it. And, you know, back in those days, Melissa, this was the last of the really small, intimate Olympic Winter Games.
And Sandy, right here to our right is Lake Placid High School, built right next to the ice.
Right.
Kids here would be in class looking out at this oval thinking maybe I could be Eric Heiden.
Well, and this is one of the great things about Lake Placid, that you let your mind wander if you're a kid. And you know, there's every reason to think that you can achieve greatness because you have access to a venue such as this.
I'm not feeling quite like Eric Heiden tonight. I don't know about you, Sandy.
No. They'll never mistake us.
But not bad for a public radio host.
Right.
On course.
Last Friday night, it seemed all of Lake Placid turned out to watch a World Cup aerials competition, an Olympic qualifying event. The cold night air glittered with silver crystals like magic dust as skiers flew and twisted and flipped under a quarter moon.
Here we go. With a back Lake Cup full pull, he's from Canada!
Amanda Rondo of nearby Au Sable Forks had bundled up her 4-year-old daughter, Katie, to come watch. Katie has been skiing since she was 19 months old. And her mom says in a town like Lake Placid, which churns out winter Olympians like crazy, an Olympic future for Katie seems possible.
Oh, yeah, it definitely, I would think, would be in reach. I mean, just state-of-the-art facilities and so much knowledge and passion behind it that we have up here.
The Lake Placid area has sent at least one athlete to every Winter Olympics since they began in 1924. And it's no wonder when you look around. Everywhere you go here, you are surrounded by active Olympic training venues. You think you want to try ski jump? Go on over to the terrifying 26-story tall jump on the outskirts of the village. Tempted by bobsled or luge? Their competition tracks are here too. This year, the Lake Placid area will send 10 athletes to Vancouver. Some have been competing against each other for decades.
This is a picture that was taken when the boys were approximately 9, 10 years old. And you can see on the podium, first place is Lowell Bailey. Second place is Bill DeMung. Third place is Timmy Burke.
And they're all going to Vancouver.
Going to Vancouver.
That's Helen DeMung. Her son Bill is a world champion in Nordic combined. That's cross-country skiing and ski jumping. Bill's buddies, Tim Burke and Lowell Bailey, are strong Olympic contenders in biathlon, which combines cross-country and rifle shooting. Helen DeMung says winter sports are just in these kids' blood.
I was 8 months pregnant with Bill at the 1980 Olympics, and I remember patting my belly thinking, this is my Olympic baby.
It worked.
And Elizabeth Bailey remembers her husband skiing the backcountry with baby Lowell on his back.
I remember Lowell could barely say much except, faster, faster, sure. Pop. I'm sure, Jack, you probably had Tim on your back.
Sure.
And we so these this. Kids grew up, like, before they could skiing. Mm.
There's not a lot of the typical distractions that you might have if you're in a more populated area.
This is Jack Burke, Tim's dad.
They couldn't go to a mall if they wanted to.
Now, the U.S. has never won a medal in either biathlon or Nordic combined. So Helen DeMung says hopes are riding high on these local athletes.
Because we have been the underdog for so long. If they medal, it will bring it to the attention of Americans. That's what speaks to Americans' results.
And these Olympic parents say their kids would love to see another wave of young athletes fall in love with these sports and come up behind them. I'm Melissa Block in Lake Placid, New York.